social worker for more than 20 years, so I've always been really fascinated by human nature, our behaviour and our relationships. Let me just see if I can work this. We have no hesitation in understanding that God is good. Everyone pretty much agrees with that. But what about us? What about each other? I've seen a lot of ugliness, and I know that a lot of other people have too. I've seen it directed at refugees and people in immigration detention. I'm under no illusion about what we're capable of. Just this week, we've heard about the war crimes committed by Australians in Afghanistan. And I reckon it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably a lot more that goes on that we don't have evidence of. So firstly, let me ask you a question. Imagine an aeroplane. It makes an emergency landing and it breaks into three parts. As the cabin fills with smoke, everybody inside realises we've got to get out of here. What happens? On planet A, the passengers turn to their neighbours and ask if they're okay. Those that need assistance are helped out of the plane first. People are willing to give their lives, even for perfect strangers. On planet B, it's everyone for themselves. Panic breaks out. There's lots of pushing and shoving. Children, the elderly and people with disabilities get trampled underfoot. Now the question is, what planet do you think we live on? So let's go for a show of hands. Who's for planet A, where we're helping each other? Planet B. Okay, so more of the planet B. Interestingly, the professor from the university in the Netherlands who poses that question finds that 97% of people say we're on planet B. So we're actually a fairly optimistic lot. So the author of this book has explored this question. Where are we? What are we capable of? Are we good after all? I don't normally read non-fiction books, but I stumbled across this in the library and just got right into it. It's hugely detailed, and it kind of blew my mind a little bit. I don't think I'm ignorant, but there's a lot in here that just really stunned me. There's no way I've got time to go into the detail that he does. So I apologise in advance when I'm telling you stories or reading bits of it or trying to give you an overview. There's going to be bits that are lost in translation. If you've got time and you're inclined, I'd encourage you to read the whole book. Here we are. It's called Humankind by Rutger Bregman. In Romans, Paul talks about that struggle to do good in terms of that natural tendency to do bad. That's often in Christian circles framed as the consequence of original sin. So created in God's image, yes, but now do we actually start our lives with the odds stacked against us? What does that mean? Can we be good without God's help? Like we said, I don't have the answers for that. But I'd like to share some of the stories and some of the information from this book to help us think about it. I'm not going to give all the answers, like I said. I'm not going to give the connection necessarily to what your Christian worldview is, because I trust you that you're going to be able to listen with that lens in place and have those conversations and those thoughts. The first thing he looks about is, why is it that so many people believe that we're actually on planet B? And there's a lot of philosophers who've talked about this theory, and they've called it veneer theory. Has anyone heard of it? Basically, we're pretty good on the outside, but it doesn't take much. Scratch below the surface and you'll find some ugliness and some selfishness. Bregman looks at what happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. I know that Rani was actually there, so we're all familiar with that story. I don't know about what your public knowledge is of that, but there was a lot going around in the media about what happened to those people who were trapped together in the Superdome. There were stories of rape, murder, widespread looting. Does anyone hear those kinds of things that happened? Interestingly, the news picked up those stories and ran with it. Prominent historian stated, "You remove the basic staples of life and we go back within hours to a war of all against all. And a few might become temporary angels, but most become apes." Interestingly, it wasn't until a few months after the water had receded and people went in, and some historians and journalists did some digging around, you found that there was no murders. There were no rapes. And yes, there was widespread looting. People banded together with the police in an effort to redistribute resources to people in need. The media have such a massive role in perpetrating this idea. The author also talks a lot about our innate cynicism. Even when we see something good happening, yeah, but what are they really after? Okay, so we see videos of people doing good stuff and we just don't believe that they're really doing it selflessly. He also addressed the book The Lord of the Flies. Who's read it? So we're all fairly familiar with the concept, yeah? It was hugely popular. William Golding, apparently the secret of his success was he so accurately portrayed the reality of the human condition. He won a Nobel Prize for it. The author wondered whether or not the Lord of the Flies actually really represented the human condition. And he wanted to know, you know, this is just a story and everyone resonated with it, but what if it actually really happened? Is there any real life stories where some kids or some people get stranded together on an island? And look, it's a fascinating story and the detail that he goes through on how he tracked down this story. But there was actually, in 1966, a real life story of six young boys from the age of 13 to 16 who were stranded on a remote island. They left Tonga in a search for adventure and were stranded on an island for 15 months. And the author also managed to track down the ship's captain who found them and one of the boys. And they are living in all of places in Brisbane. Let me just read what he found. "By the time we arrived," Captain Warner wrote in his memoirs, "the boys had set up a small commune with food garden, hollowed out tree trunks to store rainwater, a gymnasium with curious weights, a badminton court, chicken pens, and a permanent fire, all from handiwork, an old knife blade, and much determination. It was for Ty, later an engineer, who after countless failed attempts, managed to produce a spark using two sticks. While the boys in the make-believe Lord of the Flies came to blows over the fire, those in the real-life Lord of the Flies tended their flame so it never went out for over a year. The kids agreed to work in teams of two. They drew up a strict roster for garden, kitchen and guard duty. Sometimes they quarrelled, but whenever that happened, they solved it by imposing a time out. The squabblers would go to opposite ends of the island to cool their tempers, and after 4 hours or so, Mano later remembered, we'd bring them back together, and then we'd say, 'Okay, apologise.' That's how we stayed friends. They began their days and ended with songs and prayer. Colo fashioned a makeshift guitar from a piece of driftwood, half a coconut shell and 6 steel wires salvaged from their wrecked boat, an instrument that Peter, the captain, has kept all these years, and played it to lift their spirits. And their spirits needed lifting. All summer long, it hardly rained. It drove the boys frantic with thirst. They tried constructing a raft in order to leave the island, but it fell apart in the crashing surf. Then there was a storm that swept across the island and dropped a tree on their hut. Worst of all, Fatai slipped one day, fell off a cliff and broke his leg. The boys picked their way down after him and then helped him back to the top. They set his leg using sticks and leaves and said, "Don't worry, we'll do your work for you while you lie there like a king." The boys were finally rescued on Sunday, the 11th of September 1966. Physically, they were in peak condition. The local physician later expressed his astonishment at their muscled physiques and Fatai's perfectly healed leg. You can't consider human nature without addressing the reality. Hang on. Here's a picture of roughly where Atta is. It is uninhabitable. People have even tried to take trips there and have gone. And lots of detail in the book about the story. It's really fabulous. And what happened to those kids and Peter afterwards. And here is a picture of Peter the captain and one of the boys. We can't look at human nature without considering war and our capacity to kill each other. For centuries, we've engaged in war. And those wars have involved hand-to-hand combat, people killing other people. The author doesn't disappoint here either. Painstaking analysis, beginning with the discoveries of historian Colonel Samuel Marshall during the Second World War. He was trying to understand why a particular offensive had nearly failed, and when he did his analysis, he discovered that most people hadn't actually shot their guns. Worked out to be about 15%. After analysing many factors, he discovered that when the time came, most people found it really hard to kill another person. In his 1946 book, Men Against Fire, Marshall stated that the average, normally healthy individual has such an inner, usually unrealised, resistance towards killing a fellow man that he will not, of his own volition, take someone's life. And there's tons of analysis, not just on that particular offensive, but a whole lot of other ones where they have discovered that it is only about 15% of frontline troops who will actually be willing to shoot at another person. Even looking at the Gettysburg battle in the Civil War, they discovered that 90% of the bayonets were still loaded. Some of them were double, triple loaded. Think about what that means. What's a really good excuse not to shoot someone? I'm busy reloading my gun. Which is good news. And in recent years, a steady stream of experts have rallied behind his conclusions. Bregman's also spent some time in the book considering our history. How did we get here? We know that we are capable of doing bad things to others. He compares the cooperative way that we used to live as nomads and tries to understand what happened. He looked at several leading philosophers: Augustine, Machiavelli, Hobbes, Luther, Calvin, Burke, Bentham, Nietzsche, and Freud, and they all talked about our inability to be good unless we are being controlled by the state. This is where, unfortunately, organised religion gets a little bit of a mention and it doesn't come out well. The author looks at the reason behind organised religion being mostly about control of the masses. Hard for the state to control everyone, but if you've got the unseeing eye, more people are more likely to behave. A slightly less well-known French philosopher, years later, in fact, he was 30 years after Hobbes was dead, proposed a completely different idea. He pointed to the fact of ownership of stuff being part of the problem for civilization. Let me read you a quote from him. He was in the 1700s. "The first man who, after enclosing a piece of ground, took it in his head to say, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the true founder of civil society. How many crimes, how many wars, how many murders, how many misfortunes and horrors would that man have saved the human species, who, by pulling up the stakes or filling in the ditches, should have cried to his fellows, 'Be sure not to listen to this impostor. You are lost if you forget that the fruits of the earth belong equally to us all and the earth itself to nobody. Think about it. If we weren't arguing over who owned what would we have to fight about? Is it people who are bad, or is it the way that our society is organised? Hobbes concluded that human nature is irredeemable and the only solution was strict control by someone in power. Rousseau, who I've just read from, he argued the opposite. He said that people are good, and the very things that Hobbes said is our salvation are the cause of the problem. Being controlled by people in power brings out the worst in people. And Bregman sets out in his book to try and understand which one of these is true. And from here, it's important to consider a significant area of knowledge that also tells us not only that people are capable of being bad, but it believes it can explain why: social psychology. And I know there's lots of psychologists in the room, and myself, I've done some significant periods of undergraduate psychology study. In fact, only recently, a lot of these things which he goes through, and I'll spend a few minutes on now, I was taught only very recently. You guys might know some of these experiments. Who's familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment? All right, some people are familiar with this. For those who aren't, in 1971, a psychologist, Philip Zimbardo, set up a mock prison in the basement of the university. It was supposed to be a two-week experiment, but it had to be abandoned after only 6 days because the prison guards became so brutal. And there's even the famous breakdown of a prisoner on day two. Now, what has been widely said about this experiment is that it was completely uncontrolled. These people were randomly assigned the roles of guards or prisoners, and there was no rules, there was no dictation as to what they should do, and that these people themselves took it upon themselves to be brutal. Interestingly, that's probably not the case. Can you find Stanford? We're just going to show you a brief clip, which is some of the stuff which I did my learning on, which is the publicly available information.
On the second day of Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment, the guards quashed the prisoner rebellion.
They punished them by putting them in solitary confinement, which was a small closet. You could squat or stand, but you know, you couldn't sit, and it was dark and dank, actually.
Every hour, every day, there's a teeny little bit more of an increment. And they're stepping up, taunting the prisoners, they're stepping up, the count's not letting them sleep, they're stepping. I don't think from 1 minute to the next, the people who are in it see the change and see the difference.
And then the next key thing happened beside the rebellion, prisoner 8612, he was the first one to have an emotional breakdown.
I feel really inside, you don't know, I gotta go, to a doctor, anything. I mean, Jesus Christ, I'm burning up inside, don't you know? I don't know how to explain it, I'm up inside! Help me out! Help me out now!
At the time, if you had questioned me about the effect I was having, I would say, well, you know, they must be a wimp. They're weak or they're faking. Because I wouldn't have believed that what I was doing could actually cause somebody to have a nervous breakdown. It was just us sort of getting our jollies with it. You know, let's be like puppeteers here. Let's make these people do things.
What if I told you to get down on that floor? What would you do then?
The guards now began to escalate their use of power. Some of them had prisoners clean out toilet bowls with their bare hands. They now taunt, humiliate, degrade the prisoners in front of each other, and they exert arbitrary control over the prisoners.
They keep thinking of more and more unusual things to do. And very soon after the fourth day,
it's pretty disturbing. And people are familiar roughly with, you know, those who are aware of the experiment, aware of the conclusions behind that is, you know, put people in the situation and it doesn't take much for them to be brutal. Bregman just takes so much effort to uncover the full picture. And it might surprise you to discover that this was an elaborate hoax. Too much detail to go into here, but there are recordings from Zimbardo's own archives that were never published that proved, firstly, the experiment was not his idea. It was the idea of one of the guards. The guards also met beforehand and workshopped all the ways that they were going to be cruel. There's recordings of them pulling aside lenient guards and telling them to get with the program. Even that video we just watched of the famous breakdown, it's fake. The guy who was a student, he thought he would get some time to do some reading and catch up on his study, and when they took his books from him, he wanted to go home. He tried telling them that he had a stomach ache and they ignored him, so he faked a breakdown so he could go home and do some study. He told Zimbardo this. He also told a documentary filmmaker, and his statement about that was edited out of anything that was ever published. What would happen if we set up this experiment without manipulating it? Would we ever know what would happen if you put a group of people together and made some prisoners and some guards? Well, interestingly, we do know, because in 2001, two British psychologists were offered the opportunity by a BBC reality TV show because they thought it'd make great TV. Let me just tell you how it turned out. On day two, another suggested sharing the guards' food with the prisoners to boost morale. On day four, when it looked like some sparks might fly, a guard advised a prisoner, "If we can get out of this, we can go down the pub and have a drink." Another guard chimed in, "Let's discuss this like human beings." On day five, one of the prisoners proposed setting up a democracy. On day six, some prisoners escaped from their cells. They headed over to the guards' canteen to enjoy a smoke, where the guards soon came to join them. On day seven, the group voted in favour of creating a commune. A couple of guards did belatedly try to convince them to go back to the original regime, but they weren't taken seriously. With the experiment at an impasse, the whole thing had to be called off. The final episode consisted mostly of footage of men lounging around on a sofa. At the very end, we're treated to some sentimental shots of the subjects hugging one another and one of the guards giving the prisoners his jacket. Meanwhile, the viewers felt cheated. Where are the chained feet? Why no paper bags over their heads? When can we expect the sadistic games to begin? The BBC broadcast 4 hours of end-to-end smoking, small talk and sitting around. Or as the Herald Sun summed up, what happens when you put good men in an evil place and film it for television? Not that much, actually. I probably don't have time to show all my videos, but the other one, which is part of social psychology, is Kitty Genovese. Who's heard about the murder of Kitty Genovese? A classic bystander effect. So Kitty was murdered in New York, and there are supposed to have been 38 eyewitnesses who did nothing. You can Google it. It's a classic story. It is part of, like I said, psychology's main understanding around that bystander effect. People heard, but they just didn't do anything. No one called the police. She was assaulted over a period of time. If someone had intervened, she wouldn't have died. Again, Bregman digs into the archives, digs into the facts, finds out that actually people did call the police. The police didn't respond, and they proposed that they didn't respond because they probably assumed it was a marital spat, and in those days, police just didn't respond to that kind of stuff. Again, some journalists tried to print the facts years later, but their publishers refused them permission on the grounds that this story already had a life of its own and we couldn't go against what was generally understood to have happened. So what does happen if you're confronted with a stranger in distress? How could we figure this out? Again, the author has done a lot of digging, and he found a psychologist who thought they could figure this out by reviewing CCTV footage. This woman got hold of thousands of hours of CCTV footage across multiple cities and then looked at whenever there was an incident of someone in distress, being attacked or being assaulted or whatever, looked to see whether or not the bystanders responded, and found that in 90% of situations, they did. I don't have time to go into the details here, but there's another famous experiment. Who is familiar with Stanley Milgram's experiments on obedience? Yeah, the psychologists. Yeah, the electric shock one. He asked... Yeah, we'll just play Milgram.
When I learn of incidents such as the massacre of millions of men, women, and children perpetrated by the Nazis in World War II, how is it possible, I ask myself, that ordinary people, who are courteous and decent in everyday life, can act callously, inhumanely, without any limitations of conscience? These are questions that concern me.
It is May 1962. An experiment is being conducted in the Elegant Interaction Laboratory at Yale University.
Psychologists have developed several theories to explain how people learn. One theory is that people learn things correctly whenever they get punished.
What inspired Milgram, I would say there were a number of factors. One of them is he was very ambitious. He wanted to make a mark in social psychology. And he wanted, as he wrote to one friend, he wanted to come up with the boldest experiment that he could think of.
Teacher, would you take the test and be seated in front of the shock generator, please, in the next room?
Milgram's experiment was rigged. The so-called learner was part of the experiment. The real subject was the teacher.
Shock of 75 volts.
Now, as teacher, you are seated in front of this impressive-looking instrument, the shock generator. Its essential feature is a line of switches that goes from 15 volts to 450 volts, and a set of verbal designations that goes from slight shock to moderate shock, strong shock, very strong shock, intense shock, extreme intensity shock, and finally XXX, danger severe shock. Now the question is, how far will you proceed on the generator before you turn to the experimenter and refuse to go any further?
Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 105 volts. Hard hit. Just how far can you go in this thing?
As far as is necessary.
What do you mean, as far as is necessary?
To complete the test.
Milgram was very much aware that obedience is a necessary ingredient for society to function. But he focused on the darker side of obedience.
Incorrect. 150 volts. Sad face.
Wait a minute. That's all. Get me out of here. I told you I had heart trouble. My heart's starting to bother me now.
It's absolutely essential that you can...
When I learn of incidents such as the massacre of millions of men, women, and children perpetrated by...
Something like 68% of people continue to shock the subjects. And it was, you know, it was meant to explain how people could do bad stuff to other people. But did it really? When the study was over, Milgram sent participants a questionnaire, and one question was, how believable did you find the situation? Not until 10 years later did he finally publish the answers in the very last chapter of his book about his experiments. And this is where we discover that only 56% of his subjects believed they were actually inflicting pain on the learner. And that's not all. A never-published analysis by one of Milgram's assistants revealed that the majority of people called it quits if they did believe these shocks were real. So if nearly half the participants thought the setup was fake, where does that leave Milgram's research? Publicly, he described the discoveries as revealing profound and disturbing truths about human nature. But privately, he had his doubts. Whether all this ballyhoo points to significant science or merely effective theatre is an open question. He wrote in his personal journey in 1962, I'm inclined to accept the latter. What then? Why then would people do this kind of stuff? It's a really interesting conclusion that he reaches, and I think it's something really worth thinking about. He believes that in these experimental situations, people thought they were contributing to knowledge. It's a university, I'm part of a study, they want me to do it, so I'll help. Think about it. People who do bad things sometimes actually think they're doing the right thing. They think they're doing good. They might be wrong, but their intention is to do something good. Many of the atrocities committed in human history were done by people who believed in the value of what they were doing, misled by those in power, most definitely. There's a classic quote from Adolf Eichmann just before he died. He said, I have no regrets. I will leap into my grave laughing because the feeling I have 5 million beings on my conscience is for me a source of extraordinary satisfaction. He believed in what he was doing. He believed it was good. I don't know how he got there, but part three of the book considers the question of why good people turn bad. I don't have time to go into the research around empathy and how that blinds us and how power corrupts our leaders. The author also looks at motivation, thinking about how our workplaces are designed, thinking about the carrot and the stick, and really it's just not enough to explain why we might go mountain climbing, volunteering, or have children. He outlines a couple of workplaces. One Dutch healthcare group got rid of all the managers, put them in groups of 50 and said, "You're responsible. You make your decisions. You're responsible to the people that you care for." Productivity went up, efficiency went up, work satisfaction went up when people are not being controlled or told what to do. They actually work really well. Another example is a French parts company, Favi. They got, again, set people up in groups of 25 to 30, let them make every decision. Work hours, rate of pay, everything. They were answerable only to their customers. Unless they asked for help, they were completely autonomous. Their production, the time it took them to produce parts went down from 11 days to one, and they expanded from 100 employees to 500, and they're the only parts company not to have to move out of Europe. There's also some fantastic examples of participatory democracy, participatory budgeting, that interestingly we don't hear about. I don't know, does anyone know that in 2004 the Venezuelan city of Torres elected a mayor who his only platform was that I'll hand over the whole budget to the people? And he did, $7 million. And it went really, really well. In fact, by 2016 there are 1,500 examples of participatory budgeting around the world. Again, I've never heard of them. Has anyone heard of the Alaskan Permanent Fund? So in 1960, they had massive oil revenue, and thankfully the person in charge said, "No, this belongs to Alaskans. We're not just going to give it to the government." They set up a permanent fund, so the dividends goes to every Alaskan. Every year, Alaskans get about $3,000. There's no means testing, there's no strings attached to how you spend it, and researchers have found that it actually helps people. It doesn't impact on their willingness to work. They invest it in their children and their education. Jesus had a lot to teach us about believing in people and expecting the best from them. He had a tremendous impact on Zacchaeus, and as Bregman discovered, believing in people's capacity to good also produces good things. The book showcases two Norwegian prisons, Halden and Bastøy. Here the inmates are treated really well. I don't have time to describe. They've got everything, and they've got their own kitchens, they've got knives, they've got recording studios. They're producing records under the label criminal records. You know, there's an island, and they have a gym, they have everything, and it works really well. Their recidivism rate is 50% less than other places. As the warden explains, he said it's really very simple. You treat people like dirt and they'll be dirt. You treat them like human beings and they'll act like human beings. And there's a fascinating analysis in this book where he compares that to the US model of punitive, aggressive policing and the outcomes there.
In every way, we have that sort of in-wall policy. They have the prison bars. And the prisoners go out and they contribute, so they all contribute to country clubs, they contribute across the gym track, they maintain the gym track, they can count on their hands. And it's generally very well. So they are known in the community and they are
There are some really good examples out there. Again, thanks media for not sharing that with us. The book looks at racism and terrorism and all the different initiatives that exist to counter them. It stumbles across a simple and profound truth that contact with other people, spending time with them, is actually a powerful way to overcome prejudice. Here's a very simple map. Prejudice, the amount of voyages seamen were making with mixed crews. The number of voyages they took, their prejudices went down. I was stunned as a kid to hear the story about, you know, the Christmas soccer game. Who's all heard this 1914 Christmas soccer game? What I didn't realise was that it was more than just one soccer game. It was widespread. There was singing, sharing of gifts. They ate together. They sat in each other's trenches. They shared drinks together. They exchanged addresses. They had joint burial services. It's now estimated that two-thirds of the British front stopped and hung out together for Christmas. And it wasn't just there. It also happened along the Belgian and French lines. There's also recorded evidence that this happened during the Spanish Civil War, the Boer Wars, the American Civil War, Crimean and Napoleonic Wars, but none as widespread as that Christmas in Flanders. And why? Because the propaganda and the media told us that the people in power didn't want us to know. They didn't want us to think of the other people as humans like us. The British were stunned at how friendly the Germans were. Why? Because they'd been told by the propaganda, their Rupert Murdoch of the day, even the Germans were portrayed as ferocious people, spearing infants, stringing priests up by church bells. The Germans had written a song of hate, which was almost as popular as the national anthem. And the French, they believed that the French and English were so godless they didn't even celebrate Christmas. They were told this. We're getting the same story today. The same hate is being given to us in newspapers, blogs, tweets, social media. My favourite story of all from this book is the reverse of that. Can you use propaganda in reverse? Yes, you can. In 2006, the then defence minister in Colombia employed an ad agency to start a strategy to counteract the FARC, the oldest guerrilla army, which had been waging war for 50 years. They'd killed in excess of 220,000 people in that time. But they started with the assumption that the guerrillas were people just like them, with hopes and dreams and families. That's where they targeted their campaigns. There were three of them around Christmas time. First, they dropped Christmas lights on these 75-foot trees in 9 locations. They had motion sensors and banners that when someone walked past, it lit up and said, "If Christmas can come to the jungle, you can go home. At Christmas, everything is possible." 331 guerrillas left. The next year they did rivers of light. They put messages and gifts and lights inside transparent Christmas decorations and dropped 6,000 of them in the river, which was their main access point. Again, hundreds more went home. The last campaign they did was they got the mums to get childhood pictures of them with notes that said, "Before you were a fighter, you were my son." And again, more people went home. They combined this with a reintegration program. And I didn't know this, but in 2011, the defence minister, who was now the president, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his effort. And the year after that, the last guerrilla walked out of the jungle and handed in his weapon. There's a whole lot of rules to live by and examples of things what we can do in response to that. I don't have time to go into them all in detail. But he talks about believing the best. You know, he compares that with Donald Trump's quote in his book, Think Big and Kick Ass. In a great deal, you win, not the other side. You crush the opponent and come away with something better for yourself. But why not try and find a solution, an idea like the Norwegian prisons, where everyone wins? Don't punch Nazis. This brings me to my last little story. And that is, we've all seen so much recently about Black Lives Matter protests. Everyone's protesting one side and then the other comes out. And what happens when they all get together? It's ugly. There's a small town in Germany where the cemetery of Adolf Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, resides. And every year on the anniversary of his death, the neo-Nazis come out for a march, and all the anti-fascists go up against them, and it always ends badly. In 2014, someone came up with a different idea. The town residents decided to instead turn the Hess march into a charity walk. They would make donations for every metre the skinheads walked. to Exit Deutschland, an organisation supporting people to exit far-right groups. Unbeknown to the neo-Nazis, the town set up start and finish lines and lined the streets with banners thanking the walkers for their effort. They lined the streets, cheered them loudly, and showered them with confetti as they finished. They raised over 20,000 euros for the cause. I'd love to spend some bit of time talking about what I do myself and how I use my skills to help people unravel why they personally struggle to do good, but I don't have time. As Bregman concludes, when we're holed up in our trenches, we lose sight of reality. We're lured into thinking that a small hate-mongering minority reflects all humankind. To believe people are hardwired to be kind isn't sentimental or naive. On the contrary, it's courageous and realistic to believe in peace and forgiveness. The truth is as old as time, because like all the best things in life, the more you give, the more you have. That's true of trust and friendship, and it's true of peace. I hope you found this talk helpful and hopeful. Who knows why exactly some people do bad things, but I believe it does give us hope. There are lots of good things happening in the world, and I believe that we have a mandate to be involved in positive change. I believe that God created people to be good and to connect with others and to be kind to one another. Whether you come to God because you need him and you don't think you can be good without him, or, like Claire talked about last week, you come to God because he's home for you, who am I to judge? Thank you.